Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Norma Walden, a program coordinator of the club's International Relations Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our online and radio audiences, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our main speaker today, Jake Bright, is co-author of The Next Africa, An Emerging Continent Becomes a Global Powerhouse. He is justifiably proud that the book won an Axiom Best Business Book Award and was recently featured at TEDx. Jake also contributes about Africa for TechCrunch. In today's talk, he will focus particularly on sub-Saharan Africa's emerging technology sector and its growing ties to Silicon Valley. Jake is a Woodrow Wilson Visiting Fellow and a Whitehead Fellow of the Foreign Policy Association. He contributes as an editor and also independently for Fortune, the Financial Times, This Is Africa, Bloomberg LP, and U.S. News and World Report. Following our program, Jake will sign copies of his book in the lobby. Please help me welcome Jake Bright.
Well, thank you, Norma. I have to really give special thanks to her. She and I have been talking about this event for, I don't know, months now, and there were periods when it was happening, periods when it wasn't, and in the end, we were able to pull it off. So I'm so happy we're here, and thank you, Commonwealth Club. And I also just want to give some recognition. I have some family at the event, book events that have family are special to me because family's been so big in terms of everything I've done, so my aunt Vicky and Uncle Dan are here, which is great for me. And they knew me back when I was very young and had these crazy ideas about going and traveling around the world and going to Africa, and they're very supportive. So all these years later, it turned out leading to a book. So thank you. So today we're going to talk about Africa, obviously, the next Africa. And my co-author and I, Aubrey Ruby, have been doing events for, I think 9 months now on four different continents. And when I speak to rooms, I never know where people's orientations are with Africa. So some people may be experts, some won't. I'll try to do my best to not be too basic for some and maybe too detailed for others. But you just never know where people are going to start with Africa. But we'll start with a little bit of reference. So it's important just to, I think, recognize how massive Africa is in terms of a continent. You know, 54 countries, 48 in sub-Saharan Africa. You're looking at 1 billion people. Tremendous diversity geographically, linguistically, ethnically, and also a fairly challenged history, I think, comparatively to other continents. You know, every continent has its own challenges, but, you know, Africa first had this probably the world's worst, you know, brutal system perpetrated around it in slavery for many years. Then it went into the colonial era, which basically it was ruled by outside powers. And then once it had a chance to breathe in the independence era, it became really the proxy board for the Cold War superpowers in the Cold War. So, you know, Africa's had some challenging past, and largely related to that, it's probably why when it comes to Americans, if Americans have related at all to Africa, it's been very little. And if they have, it's been, you know, largely through maybe bad news headlines, maybe a friend who did Peace Corps, or maybe a donation to a celebrity charity. And that's one of the reasons why Aubrey and I decided to write this book, because we have a business focus toward Africa, which isn't so usual. And we started to come across, you know, some cross-cutting trends that we thought we're going to reshape how people, Americans in particular, and the world were going to interact with Africa over the next 20 years. And we believe it's going to be very different and much more significant in the next 20 years than it has been in the past 20. So I'll give you a little book background and just some housekeeping on what we'll do today. We're going to take a tour of this book, which is really a tour of Africa through the next Africa's eyes and what Aubrey and I did. And then we're going to do a panel with some sources for the book and for some people that are very tied to things that are covered in the book. So one of the overarching themes of this book for us was this theme of Africa being disconnected from a globalized perspective in the way that you look at things through business and economics and globalization over the last 20 years, to connecting. And one of the constructs that we came up with is Africa emerging from this 3%, less than 3% world. And what that means is that when Aubrey and I went through all these factors for how you would look at a continent or a region or countries when it comes to business or investment or global ties, in almost every category, Africa comes up as less than 3%. So, for example, less than 3% of foreign direct investment, Africa. When it comes to global trade, Africa, less than 3%. When it comes to global Google News hits, less than 3%. You go through all these categories, and Africa's been less than 3% in almost every one of them. And what we're seeing is Africa's emerging from that less than 3% world and connecting very rapidly, you know, in many different ways. Another big theme in the book, as Norma mentioned, is technology and entrepreneurs, which we spent a lot of time working with, and we'll have some of those folks speaking today. Another big theme of the book is this phrase, FABA, for Africa by Africans. And it really denotes, more so than ever before, Africans across every field taking charge of, you know, their development, their private sector, their public sector. Whereas in the past, you might have been more likely to hear about outsiders when it comes to Africa. Well, now you're starting to really hear about Africa more so than ever before from Africans. Another big connection with the book was this new contemporary ties between Africa and the United States. And Aubrey and I worked to illuminate a lot of those ties and explain how what we're talking about in this book connects very much to a new African diaspora of immigrants over the last, you know, 10 to 20 years. So just a little bit on our book lens. We know that Africa is not a country. It was a little daunting to try to write a conclusive book about an entire continent, and we were conscious of that. So we know it's not a country. I mentioned the diversity. We generalize inevitably because it was the only way to write the book, but we did it as data-driven as possible and with as much good analysis as possible. And we also realize that we might come up short in some of our analyses, but we feel like it was worth it to start launching new conversations about the continent, and we feel like it was time to do that. The other thing I mentioned is it was very important for us to integrate non-African perspectives. There's been a tremendous amount of license taken from outsiders to draw these hard and fast conclusions about Africa. So for us as non-Africans writing about Africa, we interviewed, I think, over 100 people on the continent, and it was very important for us to illuminate that. The other thing that we tried to drive in this book was suggesting a new way to look at Africa for policymakers, for citizens, for business people. And one of the things that we talk about is trying to reconcile Africa's progress with its challenges, because for some reason there's a tendency for people to look at Africa as a straight up or down proposition, where it's going to be a mixed bag. There's going to be progress and steps forward and steps backward like anywhere else in the world. And that's what we really tried to drive and get people to look at Africa from a net sum perspective, meaning, you know, the good minus the bad. And also realize that it will be increasingly less possible to analyze Africa effectively through narrow sectors, meaning business without politics, you know, markets without security. So we drove that heavily in the book. Another key thing for us was Nigeria is a 21st century bellwether. So the West African country of Nigeria, we feel, simultaneously embodies more of Africa's problems and potential than any other country on the continent. And the other thing about Nigeria that distinguishes it is it's now the continent's largest country by population, and it's now its largest economy. So you have those dual distinctions that keep bringing you back to Nigeria when you get into Africa. And then finally, and I'll revisit this hopefully with some more strength at the end of this, is we strongly feel that what you're going to see is a future where Africa's problems definitely don't go away, and the things you hear about or maybe more familiar with don't go away. But you're finally going to see a future where Africa's progress starts to overshadow its challenges. So let's jump into that. One of the things that jump-started a lot of new conversations about Africa is around 2010, there was this upsurge in business news around Africa. And just to give you a perspective on how disassociated Africa was from anything to do with business, Aubrey and I did a little self-study for the book. And the chart is small, but I'll break it down. We did a study of Google news hits, global Google news hits associated with African business terms, business, investment, and technology, and put it in a spreadsheet and created a chart. And this was from 2006 to 2011, 2014. What you found is news hits for that, unique news hits for that in 2006, almost non-existent. I mean, we're talking numbers that were, in some cases, in the hundreds when it came to tech. Move to 2011, you start to get some numbers where Africa's coming up associated with these things. But from 2011 to 2014, you see a 1,000% increase in Google news hits in Africa related to business investment and technology. And also, you started to see almost every major forward consulting firm in the world, McKinsey, Bain, Accenture, all starting to do forward-looking reports on some part of Africa. So the question is why? What drove all this business news about Africa around 2010? And the other big context factor is 2010 was when there was almost no growth anywhere in the world, and suddenly you're starting to see things happen in Africa. So break it down in four reasons of why Africa started and has continued to get so much attention around business. The first one is its economies. There's a lot of factors that have led to Africa for, you know, last 5 to 10 years, having some of the fastest growing economies in the world. And that's become more complicated now. And there's been things globally that are causing a lot of trouble in some of these economies. But you had Africa registering now to business CEOs, to firms in a low growth world in 2010. Suddenly Africa's economies are the fastest growing, and that's popping up everywhere. The second big reason that business started to focus on Africa was investment. So you're seeing a lot of trends in Africa where things are doubling and tripling. So investment has been doubling and tripling, you know, going back to like 2005. And investment, like foreign direct investment, was one of those categories where Africa was in this less than 3% world, meaning less than 3% of global foreign direct investment going there. Well, Africa broke out of that and reached around 4%, I think, a couple years ago. And there's literally billions of dollars going into the continent through companies, through portfolio investment, issuing stocks and bonds, like things that really weren't happening in some ways before. African governments are now issuing global treasuries, which it's hard to believe. That's such a fundamental way that governments raise money around the world. Well, in terms of global bonds, until the last 3 or 5 years, some African governments had no way to do that at all for fundraising. So there's a lot of investment pouring in. The other big factor that's gotten attention on Africa is demographics. I won't go into each category, but we worked with Aliko Dangote, who's Africa's richest man and most recognized entrepreneur. And he has a phrase in the book that no matter what you think about Africa, you cannot ignore the numbers demographically. So when you get into demographic categories across the board, Africa's usually 1, 2, or 3 when it comes to fastest urbanizing population, fastest growing population, fastest growing youth, our youth labor force. So demographics has really gotten people's attention on the continent in business. And then the final one is modernization. Anybody who's been in Africa probably doesn't have a lot to rave about in terms of its infrastructure. And it's true it has many places some of the worst infrastructure in the world. But that's also a huge opportunity. And there's mass mobilization of resources going into upgrading Africa's infrastructure grid. And that's roads, bridges, ICT infrastructure, anything you can imagine. There's a ton of spending going into modernizing Africa. And this photo here is actually an export, a manufacturing plant in Ethiopia. And Ethiopia has actually started to pull away low-value-add manufacturing and even some car manufacturing from China. So that's part of this modernization. When it comes to modernization, one of the most exciting things we cover in the book is Africa's tech movement. And we have a chapter called Africa Has a Tech Movement, in quotation marks with a question mark, because when I was in New York, in some of the most in-the-know places for business in the world, i.e. Bloomberg's, you know, sixth floor, and they're like, Bright, what are you working on? You know, what's this other stuff you're writing on? I say African tech. I had people that would come back and say, Africa has a tech industry, you know, shortly as like 3 years ago. So yes, it does have a tech industry, a tech sector. It's nascent, but it's moving rapidly. And what Aubrey and I work to do is, in two chapters, is to actually start to answer the question, well, what is Africa's tech sector? So just a snapshot here, we tried to, you know, underscore some of the building blocks of African tech. And the first one that we would say is innovation centers. So innovation centers, meaning accelerators, co-creation spaces, they're popping up all over the continent. We quantified about 200 of them. The most famous one is iHub, probably iHub in Kenya, which, you know, Google CEO has been there, Eric Schmidt, Mercer Meyer has been there. And these centers are starting to do all sorts of things. They're teaching coding. They all have all different kinds of characteristics, teaching coding, mentoring entrepreneurs, hosting app competitions, and also becoming a center for a new tech culture amongst Africans' youth that's starting to sprout up. So innovation centers are a big pillar of African tech. Second one is IT entrepreneurs. You're getting a surge in African startup leaders, people getting into tech. Chris Fallion, who's here with us today, and will speak on the panel, is one of them, the African entrepreneur. And there's a pattern of a lot of the entrepreneurs that we worked with that they've worked, they're coming from the United States. They're actually Africans who have worked and studied abroad in Europe or the U.S. and actually are quitting things here to go back home and found startups. And Chris's startup is Mall for Africa, which leads me to the next thing is startups are a big pillar. There's a startup boom in Africa right now, focused primarily in several countries. But in places like Nigeria, Ghana, Kenya, South Africa, startups are sprouting up. It's almost like the U.S. in the late 90s, but in Africa's own way. Startups are sprouting up around everything. And one of the big factors for that is a huge chunk of the continent's economy is informal, meaning it's off the grid, sometimes barter-based, not connected to internet, not connected to business enterprise software. So that's a huge opportunity for startups in, you know, today's startup model to try to scale any commercial application to whatever you can imagine. Another big pillar of African tech that we tracked is investment. So we tracked, we did our own independent study. Well, we actually work with Crunchbase. We tracked around $1 billion of venture capital investment that some real, some that we expect that will go into African startups between 2012 and 2018. Some of that's coming from Silicon Valley. And then you have some investment like mainline tech companies like IBM has built a $100 million research facility in Kenya, and they've now expanded that into South Africa. So investment is really starting to trickle into African tech. And then the next thing you're starting to see is certain countries and areas are starting to distinguish themselves as regional tech hubs. So South Africa has always had a tech scene, but now Kenya has started to become known as a global tech hub for mobile money, for iHub, for Ushahidi, this globally recognized app, and also for the Kenyan government taking a lead on you know, committing itself to building out an information communication technology infrastructure. So you're starting to see that, and Kenya is referred to as Silicon Savannah. You have little Silicon Valleys. They're more like streets in some places. Yaba and Lagos, you have them in Ghana. But you're getting regional tech hubs sprouting up. And one thing here is, I don't know if anybody saw the 60 Minutes piece on Kenya with Leslie Stahl, where she went and used mobile money. M-Pesa is the app that a lot of people know about. Which is one of the most recognized mobile money apps in the world. Well, Leslie Stahl did this piece where she, in downtown Nairobi, she paid for her taxi with M-Pesa and a mobile phone, and it was on 60 Minutes on Sunday evening for a whole bunch of viewers and went all over Twitter. So expect, you know, tech in Africa is going to impact everything, education, healthcare, commerce. It's moving into just about every field you can imagine. And just four things to expect in African tech's future that are a snapshot from the book. You're going to start to see state-to-state competition, meaning governments are now seeing a responsibility to nurture tech sectors. And Nigeria's noticed what happened in Kenya, and so has Rwanda, and you're starting to see ICT ministers pop up. The second interesting thing you'll see in African tech is tech disrupting development. When I say development, I mean, you know, this 50-year kind of project of outside aid agencies and donor funds to, you know, quote, help Africans or improve things related to socioeconomic, you know, drawbacks. Well, tech is starting to fill that space as a multiplier. You have apps that are for maternal health. You have aid monies now going that used to go to NGOs. We tracked it going to tech hubs or even tech apps directly. And then you also have IBM. I mentioned they build a $100 million research facility in Kenya. One of the focuses of that is they're rebuilding, you know, Watson, the supercomputer. They're rebuilding Watson in Africa, and they're calling it Lucy. And the primary focus of that is to direct Lucy to solve some of these longstanding socioeconomic problems in Africa that never seem to go away. So tech will definitely be fueling development. Tech leapfrogging. So this concept of leapfrogging, of using tech to overcome structural deficiencies. Africa, that's probably playing out in more extreme ways than anywhere in the world. So, for example, in fintech, like M-Pesa, Kenya lacked and still lacks to some degree a retail banking sector. People needed to move money safely. People were actually giving paper sacks of money to send home to families and giving it to bus drivers to put under their seat. That was how they were sending money. So, you know, this digital app that allows Kenyans with any basic mobile phone to send money, that leapfrog Kenyans right over digital or retail banking in the digital finance era. So you're seeing all kinds of leapfrogging. You're seeing drones. Next month, the first drone delivery program on a national scale will start in Rwanda. So that's leapfrogging infrastructure deficiencies. So you're seeing leapfrogging happening in a big way in Africa. And then you're also starting to see Africa produce technology that has global application. So one thing is BRIC, which is this Wi-Fi device developed in response to African challenges. You can plop it down just about anywhere in the world, get 23 or 4G connections. It's solar. It powers itself through solar, but it also uses solar power to power all the devices. Well, BRIC is now being used in many countries in the world. And we even found a case of it being used in the U.S., developed in Africa. Another one, Ushahidi, I mentioned, is a global crowdsourcing app that's used on over 140 countries. So now you have apps developed in Africa being used abroad. And then, of course, Uber, which Matt Devlin, who's here, will speak to. Some of what Uber's doing in Africa, they're speaking about how it could have application to advanced economies, you know, later on down the road. And then finally, the thing to look for in African tech is we're about ready to, and this is one thing in the book that we're proud of because we predicted this, and it's already starting to happen, even within the last 9 months. You're starting to see Silicon Valley-type headlines come out of Africa. So unicorns. Africa has its first unicorn tech startup, Jumia AIG, which is now valued at over $1 billion. You had a big acquisition recently of Deal Day, a Nigerian e-commerce startup by a Swiss company. You're starting to see, you know, IT moguls about ready to emerge. So, you know, people never would have maybe thought you'd ever see any of this kind of stuff about Africa. And there's going to be a tremendous amount of failure, of course. But now you're starting to see these kind of tech headlines come out of Africa and very rapidly, and it's really changing a lot of paradigms. Another big part of the book was highlighting African talent. And Africa's always had innovative leaders. But one thing we found is there seems to be this surge of really talented Africans, you know, distinguishing themselves all over the world. And it's not just the continent. It's also in the diaspora, Africans in Europe, in the United States, but distinguishing themselves in just about every field you can think of. And some, in some ways, reversing brain drain. You're shifting archetypes and also influencing global culture. So I'll just go through some examples because people tell the best stories of some of the people we featured and interviewed in the book that represent this across so many sectors. You have Tayo Ovioso, who's a Nigerian who founded Paga Payments, which is a fintech startup. Tayo studied in the U.S., went to great schools here, worked at Cisco, dropped all of that out of all of that, and now he has this payment company in Nigeria. They transferred $1 billion of payments, I think, recently. And, you know, Tayo's recognized as an African tech leader. And something else to mention about Tayo is it's not just talented Africans that are going back to Africa to found startups. We found a lot of cases, and you think, you know, young people in the U.S. or Europe go to do aid work or go to do Peace Corps, which is a great program. But we've started to see MBA types, Americans who maybe would work in Silicon Valley, moving to Africa and working in Africa in the startups. So that's a big paradigm shift to see young Americans go to not just do Peace Corps, but to work in an African startup in Lagos or South Africa or Kenya. Another example is a lot of people don't know Nollywood is Nigeria's film industry, but it's also really Africa's most well-known film industry. It's the second biggest in the world by volume. And Nollywood has a lot of impact in Africa. It's hard to underscore, but some Nollywood actors, if they went places in Kenya or South Africa, it'd be like Brad Pitt walking around. But one of the directors is Kunle Afuleyan. And one of the things we talked about in the book is how Americans will someday watch Nollywood here. Well, Kunle's films are now on Netflix. You can go home and watch them tonight. So Nollywood is starting to do a lot and have global impact. A lot of people know Lupita Nyong'o, Kenyan actress, fashion icon, who's now started to branch out and do projects beyond just Hollywood. She has a Disney movie coming out about a Ugandan chess prodigy. But Lupita's also, you know, had an influence. In fashion, you have Duru Olowu, who's a Nigerian designer, who is Michelle Obama's favorite designer. She loves the guy. She names him all the time. He even somehow went from design to decorating the White House Christmas party. I can't figure that one out. But Duro is known in fashion. He also had his lines in some U.S. stores. So there you have Africans in, distinguishing themselves in fashion. In media, Omiyele Sowore is a Nigerian activist and journalist who has a site called Sahar Reporters. And really one of the most courageous guys I've ever met. He basically founded a 60 Minutes type tech media site where he outs corruption in Africa and primarily Nigeria. And he's brought down ministers, people who have gone to jail because of Omiyele's reporting. And that's another example of, another African surging and getting, he was in the New York Times and has gotten Rockefeller funding in investigative journalism. In music, Nigeria has a huge pop scene that's starting to have, you know, a recognition across the continent. But Kenya also does too. And Just a Band's one of my favorite bands we feature in the book that are, try to get this one. They're an indie, Afro-indie funk house band that does documentary films to their music and also uses a lot of technology and computers. Another example of African culture having global, impact. And then finally in tech, going to the youth, a young tech leader who became a YouTube sensation is Kelvin Doe, who got known because he won a contest and got invited to MIT for creating his own digital radio station out of spare parts that he found, garbage parts he found walking home from school. Kelvin got invited to MIT. He became the youngest visiting practitioner at MIT. I think he was 15 then. He became one of the youngest TED speakers. He became one of the youngest speakers at Harvard. And Kelvin is now a tech leader and trying to form his own lab in Sierra Leone, but it just shows some of the absorption and the hunger toward tech and also other things of Africa's youth. Another thing we covered in the book is this FABA, For Africa, By Africans. Again, in the past, you're more likely to hear people like Bono or Bill Gates or outsiders doing leadership in African development. Well, that's not the case anymore. You have some of Africa's moguls are starting to become kind of the continent's first Rockefeller, Carnegie figures, people who made money in the private sector and are really taking charge of starting their foundations and doing things altruistically. So just a couple examples, and there are a number of examples, but just three in the book. Aliko Dangote, I mentioned, Africa's richest man, made his money off of commodities trading, sugar, flour. He's endowed a foundation for $1 billion. And he's doing all kinds of philanthropical things across the continent. Strive Masiyiwa, telecoms executive, another billionaire, has his own foundation, doing all kinds of things, sending high-potential Africans on scholarship to Harvard. Patrice Motsepe is South African mining mogul, another billionaire. He recently joined the Giving Pledge, which is the pledge that people like Gates and Bloomberg have given to give away half their money to philanthropic causes by the end of their life. So you have these people starting to emerge and really, take charge of this altruistic agenda in Africa and also do a lot of other things, but it's notable. And also the Rwanda Development Board I bring up because when you look at aid and foreign aid and development agencies, you have this sense of it being from the outside. Rwanda is a country that's really taken over its development agenda. It has its own development agency, and it coordinates a lot of stuff through that. And one of my favorite things is Kenya has an ICT bus, where this bus goes around, it's Wi-Fi connected, and it teaches coding and tech skills driving around Kigali and other places in the country. Just a couple more slides. Another thing we underscored in the book was that this Africa transformation story and a lot of these trends we're talking about are not just in Africa. It's becoming a new American story, and that's happening largely through Africa's contemporary diaspora. So that's immigrants that have come here from Africa over the last two decades, and they're starting to really distinguish themselves in many ways. So one way, probably the biggest way that Africans of immigrants of the last 20 years have started to distinguish themselves is education. So the 2014 Census Bureau did a brief on Africans in the U.S. African immigrants of the last 20 years are now the highest educated demographic in the entire United States. And that's not highest immigrant educated demographic. That's the highest educated demographic of any demographic in the entire country. And this example at the bottom is every spring there's like three stories like this in the New York City area of an African immigrant. And a lot of the parents put really high premium on education because a lot of the reasons they left some of these countries were because of complications in education. But there's a story almost every spring of some one or two kids that get into all eight Ivy League schools in the New York City area. Recently, it was a Nigerian and a Ghanaian from Long Island. Well, Sahili Ibrahim was one of the people we featured, who is the daughter of Nigerian immigrants in New Jersey. And she got into all eight Ivies. She went to Harvard, and she got invited to the White House. The other thing about the diaspora that I think is shifting paradigms and is distinguishable is Africans, and this is one that really, you know, is unique. Since 2011, Africans in the diaspora, meaning immigrants, recent immigrants, are now sending home more money from remittances, meaning extra money they send home through Western Union. They're sending home more money than foreign aid for the entire continent, which I think breaks a lot of constructs when, you know, foreign aid is supposed to help people, and now Africans in the diaspora, contemporary immigrants, are now able to do so well that they're sending home more money than foreign aid. And, you know, another thing about Africans in the diaspora is they're becoming a new link. They're creating new ties between the U.S. and Africa. And one thing I often reference is, you know, my parents had a small business, and a lot of the entrepreneurs that we reference, you know, who's the first person or people you go to when you start a business? It's your family. So some of this remittance money is going to fund new businesses. And another interesting thing about the diaspora I like to point out is this Redeemed Christian Church of God North America. It's a Nigerian church. And in Nigeria, churches do a lot. They've relocated. They have a North American chapter. They're doing all kinds of stuff. They're forming a business school. You know, half their leadership has PhDs. But they're also doing missionary work. So in the United States. So, you know, wrap your mind around this. You have Nigerian African immigrants doing missionary work in poor American neighborhoods. So that says a lot about the diaspora. Two more things. Just rapid fire, next Africa. The past Africa, you know, less than 3% world. Next Africa, digitized financial markets, greater flow of people and goods and things across borders. Past Africa, unidimensional foreign relations, meaning not a lot of partners and narrow relations. Next Africa, deeper relationships, more partners. There's a lot of countries spending a lot and investing and placing more strategic priority in Africa, including China, but not just China, Russia, India, Turkey. Past Africa, dependence on foreign aid. Next Africa, African philanthropists doing development, governments taking more charge of development. Past Africa, government as main source of wealth creation, which has actually created a lot of problems with corruption because in many countries it's the only game in town. Well, the next Africa, you're seeing, you know, a surge in business leaders and success stories across more sectors and other ways to be affluent and make money. Past Africa, brain drain. Next Africa, you have repatriate entrepreneurs, expat appeal. Past Africa, informal and old economy, private sector. Next Africa, technology and formalizing economies starting to take root in a lot of places. So final slide and we'll move to the panel. Parting point is one thing we want to say, and I don't have the time to get into it here. The book was not all overly optimistic. We had an entire section called Deal Breakers, Constraints and Deal Breakers, where we talk about how there's going to be a lot of hiccups in Africa's future. There are going to be some countries that move ahead, some don't. So I want to reiterate that by no means do all these things I'm talking about mean that the continent's challenges are going to go away and you're not going to hear about them. You definitely are. But again, I think we're getting to a point where you're going to finally see Africa's progress start to overshadow some of its problems. And the all-inclusive line that Aubrey and I use to sum up how we think Africa in particular will start to impact Americans and be very a different place for Americans in the future is this one, that in the future, more Americans are going to work for companies that are doing business in Africa. More Americans are going to have African stocks in their 401ks. Americans are going to be watching Nigerian movies on Netflix, downloading Kenyan songs from iTunes, using tech innovation that's developed in Africa. And in the future, Americans are definitely going to be learning a lot more African names than just Barack Obama and Nelson Mandela. So thank you, and we'll move to the panel. So call up our group here. So I'll skip the bios because I want to really get into some discussion in Q&A. But one of the things that Aubrey and I, it's been important to us with this book is to not just talk ourselves, but to really start new conversations and have as many people related to or in the book involved in these discussions. So we've done some events like that, and they've gone very well and been very interesting. So we have Matt Devlin from Uber. Who's familiar with Matt has actually a global responsibility for Uber, but is familiar with Africa and recently returned. Toro Herrero from Draper Dark Flow, which is a venture capital firm that's actually based here in Silicon Valley, starting to, and I think you're already on your way, investing in African tech startups. And then we have Chris Philan, who I already mentioned from Mall for Africa. And I mentioned Chris has a background of being here in the U.S. and actually, you know, changing his portfolio and what he does to go back and found a startup. So I'm just going to throw some questions around, and I think I'll start with Chris, and I'll set a little context. E-commerce in Africa right now is really big. The unicorn that I mentioned, the billion-dollar company, is actually in e-commerce. And there's a huge surge of investment going in to create e-commerce companies in Nigeria that will branch out into the rest of the continent. And if you go to, if you ever go to Century 21 in New York, a lot of times you'll see Africans there with these big, huge suitcases, piling things up that they can't find back home or can't find authentically or cheaply back home. And Chris's site, I think, really speaks a lot to that. Because mallforafrica.com kind of was formed, and I'll let Chris explain, was formed to kind of fill that gap of Africans having all these things. And it's a typical thing when you travel to Africa, people give you lists of things they want you to bring back. But that's an opportunity because obviously there's a market need that's not being met. So Chris, can you say a little bit about how you formed Mall for Africa and just how you operate and some of the partnerships that you have?
Sure. Again, my name is Chris Philayam.
Hello. Okay.
So as Jake mentioned, the way Mall for Africa was born is because I kept going back home. I'm from Nigeria. I kept going back home, and every time I went, people asked me to bring stuff. So the lists started getting longer and longer and longer, and I went to SFO. Tried to check into my Delta flight with 10 suitcases, and I was told I could not. And that was basically how the company started. So you can probably tell, you know, any good business starts with knowing when there's a problem and there's a void that you can fill. So I figured, hey, there was this void. People wanted to buy stuff. They knew what websites to go to, how much it cost, and all that stuff. And they were using me as their shopping cart, bottom line. So I decided to create an app and a software, build a software platform from the ground up that allowed them to shop on these sites and, you know, select what they wanted. And then it was, you know, like every startup started in my garage, and then from my garage it went to a big warehouse, and now we're in a 17,000 square foot warehouse, which we fill up and empty pretty much every day in Portland. But what we do is we help U.S. and U.K. stores ship to people who want their products in Africa at no risk. So for the buyer, it's a benefit of being able to access items that they've always wanted but never been able to access because the stores wouldn't ship for reasons such as fraud, when the item gets there, who can verify that the product got there, and so on and so forth. So we've created, I guess you could say, a nice line connecting the retailers to the individuals in Africa who actually want to purchase the items. So we've done this for individuals, schools. We've helped people start businesses. Like I just said, we definitely supply books to schools, medical supplies, and we help people who just want to look good, buying some really nice clothes.
And Chris, your partnerships, can you name some of them? Because they're with some of the most recognizable American companies that you can imagine. I think your platform allows people to go in and buy whatever they want from these companies, right?
Yeah.
And have it shipped to Nigeria and takes care of all the foreign exchange risk, right?
We take care of everything. Think of all the companies from Walmart to Ralph Lauren, Nordstrom's, Neiman Marcus, Best Buy, and the list goes on. Oh, right now we're at over 180 stores. We have over 5,000 brands on our platform, and we are pretty much the largest e-commerce platform in Africa at this time.
And one of the things that got covered that came out of research is Chris mentioned Mall for Africa is employing Americans in Oregon, and that was picked up in a piece we did in Fortune, and also the New York Times zeroed in on it and went and interviewed these Americans working at a warehouse of a Nigerian e-commerce startup. So that was an interesting story.
Yeah.
Well, let's move to Uber, because as we mentioned, a number of American tech companies and a number of American companies, period, are moving into Africa. And Matt and I have talked a lot about what Uber's doing, and the CEO has named Africa as a global priority. And I just thought, Matt, could you say a little bit about where Uber is? And
sure.
The other thing that's unique and I think people would want to hear is Uber is doing things in Africa that it doesn't really do anywhere else, and I think in some ways maybe seeing things in Africa that could be possibilities globally.
Sure. Yeah, I know. I think first off, it's news to some people that Uber is operating in Africa, but we've been there for some time. I think so. We launched in South Africa in August of 2013. Nigeria followed next, Lagos at the end of 2014, and then Nairobi, Kenya, early 2015. Since then, we've added Mombasa in Kenya and Abuja in Nigeria, and in the last couple of weeks, Kampala, Uganda, Accra, Ghana just a couple days ago, and in the next couple of weeks, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. So Africa is a very large continent, as we all know after Jake's map, but we're slowly getting some pretty significant coverage, which is exciting. I think the scale also of the platform, the number of people using it, the number of drivers working on it, is pretty impressive. The growth's been really remarkable. To give you a sense of it, in 2014, we did roughly 1 million trips in South Africa. And in the first half of 2015, we did 2 million. So without going into more recent data, I'd say the growth continues to be pretty exponential. More than 100,000 people open our app in Kenya every month. We have more than 4,000 drivers in South Africa. We're aiming for more than 15,000 by the end of this year. So both from the rider side in terms of increasing transportation access and from the driver side in terms of access to these flexible work opportunities, really seeing it really take off in sub-Saharan Africa. to your point about what we're seeing new there, I think the really interesting part of the story is that we're encountering some challenges simply rolling out our usual model in sub-Saharan Africa. And out of fixing those challenges, we may be finding solutions that are then scalable globally. And so kind of a key one has been credit card penetration is pretty low, in some markets extremely low. And if you've used Uber here in the U.S., you know that you get out of the car at the end of the ride and the fare is automatically charged to your account, to a credit card that's on your Uber account. That obviously was a huge barrier to growth in many markets. And so what we did is a pretty big operational change for us was to start accepting cash in these markets. And pretty much overnight, you saw ridership go through the roof. The growth was, it was just a step change. And so from a business perspective, that's exciting. I think from a broader policy perspective, that's extremely exciting. It means you're going to reach a new population, a new demographic who otherwise wouldn't have access to this service. Another one is mapping. Mapping in some of the cities we're now operating in sub-Saharan Africa is not quite what it is here in San Francisco, I think you could say. But the solutions are pretty interesting. In Nairobi, for example, instead of having a street number address, which may exist, probably doesn't, but if it does exist, no one knows how to find it. It's not really how people navigate. We've partnered with a company called OK High, and instead the driver will get a series of photos. So you'll see, this is the roundabout you're driving to, and this is the exit on the roundabout you'll go off, and then this is the white fence with the green gate, and that's where you're going, instead of number 17 on street X. So it's workarounds like that that are actually, in the short term, something of a challenge, but over the longer term, I think you're going to see that boomerang back out to other markets, and that's going to be an exciting story, I think, not just what Uber's doing in Africa, but what being in Africa can do for Uber.
So you could just take a snapshot of a landmark in the U.S. and that's how the car could find you versus giving an address someday.
But I'm thinking markets like Southeast Asia where, mapping is also less than perfect, and similarly in Vietnam, India, credit card penetration very low. So these are issues that if we want to grow to where we want to be, we're going to have to encounter. And the fact that we're finding those solutions along the way is an exciting part of the story.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Matt. And on African tech having, possible global application, I want to move to Toro, who now is running, a venture capital firm funded out of Silicon Valley. And there haven't been really many of those, if any. There's really a handful of VC firms that have any Africa focus. But one unique thing, and Tori, you can say a little bit about your firm, but one unique thing that came up is that you guys have a focus of, if I'm correct, not just investing in African tech startups that have application in Africa. You're actually looking beyond. You're looking at African tech startups that have global application. So if you could say a little bit about the firm and where you are with that, that'd be great.
What's up? Hi, I'm Toro. I'm the managing partner of Draper Dark Flow. So Draper Dark Flow is a Silicon Valley-based VC fund based out of here, and we invest in African startups that can change the world. So that's the whole idea. So we're hoping that in a few years, you'll be here sitting down using some super cool technology, and the founder's probably from Uganda or Ethiopia or Rwanda, somewhere random. So that's kind of the play. And it's been exciting so far running the fund and meeting entrepreneurs that are thinking big. I may say that I think African geniuses and African entrepreneurs and African leaders have always been there. I think what has changed over the last 10 years is just exposure and the world getting to know that they are there. So, and that's what we've seen over and over and over again. We're right now doing an event called Speed Up Africa. It helps to be the continent's coolest, biggest startup boot camp, where we're bringing 100 of the continent's top early stage startups in this 4-day epic event. And we're having people from Google and 500 startups and investors from all over the continent. But so far, by the way, we play in the early stage, so in the very seed stage part of the play. So these founders have just launched or have just raised a seed round, etc. But what we've seen so far is, and what I have been excited about is where the startups are coming from, where the founders are coming from. So from the usual suspects like Nigeria and South Africa to the unusual suspects like Mozambique. Like, you will never read about Mozambique on TechCrunch, you know? So, or Morocco.
Maybe someday. Yeah.
Hopefully. So that's what we're trying to do, right? Or North Sudan or Madagascar. So we have seen that our strategy of investing in African entrepreneurs that can change the world has kind of made us look less at the market and more at the entrepreneur and the idea. Yeah. So we know that some guy in some room without electricity in Sudan is thinking of something that could change the world. That doesn't disqualify his idea just because his market is small. So that's what we've been up to. And finally, it's been interesting to see. I think the historical challenges that African entrepreneurs have faced in the early stage has kind of made most people think extremely differently about the world, problems, and the solutions. So when talking about leapfrogging, right, which is like the whole big buzzword now, it's kind of like a natural thing for African entrepreneurs to do. It's like, I want to go there, but there's nowhere to go there. How do I go about that? I'll give an example of a founder that we're about to back. He is from, I think, Tanzania or something. And he came up with this little box that the whole idea was, he lives in this rural village, right? And he wants to watch TV. I'm like, so how can I watch TV? And there's no electricity, etc. So he comes up with like a little set of box, right, that can help him watch TV. And I was like, so how do I charge this TV? He connects a solar panel to it, and now he can charge this TV to watch it. And how can I stream YouTube? And it connects like Wi-Fi to it, and now he's come up with like a little set of box that has TV, Wi-Fi, and electricity. So so things like that are coming up.
So and drones and AI and so on. Your top sectors or what you guys are looking at the most?
Yeah. I think so. We try to be sector agnostic. I think the industry is still early. So I think for me at least, zooming in on one sector is kind of still too early. But the more, for me personally and as a fund, as a strategy, the more impossible it is, the more excited we get. So, for example, we just backed a company in AI, for example. Very long shot, very moonshot. Yeah, an AI company out of Nigeria doing like some crazy stuff, and a drone company too. Right. So we think those things will most likely fail, but they have a little chance to succeed.
Okay.
And for those little chances that they have to succeed, it will change everything, and that's why we back them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just checking on our Q&A time, Norma, are we good?
It's okay. No, nobody's leaving. You know, our programs usually last an hour, but there's another event going on. We can stay.
We'll go a couple more things, and I'll open up the Q&A. We're focused a lot on tech, and it sounds very positive, and I think in many ways it is in Africa. But tech's become obviously more complicated in the U.S. So just for balance, I have to ask a couple of balance questions. And one I want to ask, and Matt, you can weigh in, but I want to ask Toro and Chris, and start with Chris. E-commerce in Africa has gotten a huge amount of funding. Just over the last, I think, 6 months, you've seen maybe $300 or $400 million of investment go into e-commerce startups, primarily in Nigeria, and from some big names like Goldman, AXA Insurance. So the one thing that I'm curious about, Chris, is tech in Africa, I think, definitely is in a phase where it's very positive. But you're obviously going to have failure. You're going to have tech start to disrupt things in negative ways. So I'm curious if you think there's a potential that there's a tech or an e-commerce bubble, meaning that there's too much money going to African e-commerce for what those companies can actually earn. And you don't have to just speak to yours, but I'm curious your perspective and Toro's on that.
I actually don't think there's any bubble anytime soon. So, and the reason why, it's because we have, yes, we've leapfrogged a lot, but we still have a lot of ground to cover. And from all the advances that are coming with e-commerce and the benefits it's playing within the market, I I really only see it growing and getting bigger and stronger before anything like a bubble is, you know, is going to pop or anything like that. I'll give you example. So you have so in the e-commerce market in Nigeria, you have companies like you mentioned, the Deal Day that was that Ringier just acquired, and there are quite a few other e-commerce companies that Jumia has been getting a bunch of money. But what they're using the money for is really interesting. They're using the money to understand the market, to improve product lines, improve distribution and marketing strategies. So they're using it for all the right things to make the market better in that industry. So when you start using the money for stuff like that, I really don't see why there should be a bubble anytime soon. It's when you start doing silly things with the money, that's when I personally think
of
bubble. Well,
it's an interesting point, because one thing about African e-commerce is that a lot of the baseline infrastructure that e-commerce sites have here, African e-commerce sites don't have that. So they're simultaneously having to wire e-commerce, but they're also building their own delivery systems. They're building a lot of their own logistics systems. They're having to do a lot of stuff that here you just would have third parties that do it. So that is an interesting point, because a lot of that money is going into that. Toro, anything on possibility of a bubble in African e-commerce?
Oh, hell no.
okay.
yeah, and I totally agree with him. And you just said what Stewart was about to say. So all the funding is going towards the infrastructural challenges, so logistics, delivery, etc. That's where to have an efficient e-commerce layer, there has to be like some ground infrastructure in place.
Yeah.
So most of those companies are spending all that cash doing that. So I think, like I said, I think we're probably decades away from a bubble. Think, it's a true story.
There's press here, so they might put you on that.
Yeah. So I think I'm no Nostradamus, but I think here's how it's going to play out. Over the next few, maybe 1 to 2 years, it's going to be even more money going into e-commerce. From the big countries, to big e-commerce markets like Nigeria and Kenya and South Africa, and it's going to trickle down to the other little economies. And we're going to have this really big, sophisticated chain of e-commerce companies and websites that talk to each other. And there's going to be more and more people from the informal economy, which right now is 70% of the whole continent, coming into that formal economy of trading and using stuff and paying with cash and tying it into apps and stuff. And then you'll see an increase, right? And then you can talk about a bubble probably in 2050 or something.
Well, we'll remember that. But here, too, a lot of people haven't even brought up the possibility of a bubble. One more question, and we'll open it up to Q&A. How could we have Uber up here without getting into a little controversy? I wanted to ask Matt, Uber has been overwhelmingly welcome in Africa, but it hasn't escaped some of the controversy that it gains elsewhere. And you've seen some riots in Kenya of local taxi operators actually smashing up Uber cars in South Africa. So Matt, I mean, just to that, can you comment a little bit about, the obvious positive impact of Uber, and then how you guys have dealt with what some view is maybe some negative disruption in
the
African markets?
Yeah, no, sure. So I think, first off, you're exactly right. The response from the public has been overwhelmingly positive. This is considered a valuable transportation option, a solution to what is, for most people in most of these cities, the central drama of their daily life, how to get from A to B. And so the public support and the social media support has been extremely strong in pretty much every market we've been to. What's been particularly unique about Sub-Saharan Africa is how vocal the government has been in many of these markets, supporting Uber as a force for competition, a force for improved transportation, and a force for economic opportunity.
Yeah.
I think that that's really been distinctive in South Africa, and especially lately, and in Kenya. On the issue of what platforms like Uber can offer existing taxi drivers, existing providers in the transportation providers. I think a key point is that this is a technology. This is an open platform. And so what we're putting a lot of effort into, in Africa in particular, is an educational mission in articulating that. That this is a technology that increases productivity, and that this is an open platform that drivers who are already working as taxi drivers are welcome to. And so we're working to help bring those drivers on who want to work with Uber. A large part of that is vehicle financing. So we put a lot of time into vehicle financing programs in South Africa, in Nigeria, and a really good one we've just launched in Kenya now. So if people who historically haven't owned the car, rented a car from someone and worked as a taxi driver, we can get them access to good financing so they can have a car to work on the platform. And so actually chart that path forward and articulate why this can be and how this can be a positive force in people's lives.
Okay. Well, let's open it up to the audience for questions. And
I should make an announcement for possible broadcast, which I will do. Just to remind our listening audience, this is a program at the Commonwealth Club of California. Our main speaker is Jake Bright, co-author of The Next Africa, An Emerging Continent Becomes the Global Powerhouse. And we're also giving thanks to Chris Faloyan, CEO of mallforafrica.com, Matt Devlin of Uber, he is their global lead for international relations, and Toro Orero, managing partner for Draper Dark Flow. They've joined us for a discussion, and we will now welcome audience questions.
And on questions, we welcome questions, but if we can try to make sure there are actually more questions than anything else, that would be great.
And they need to be recorded, too. So we have a standing mic here, or we can carry it around.
So we'll start with this gentleman right here.
Hi, I'm Gerald Harris. I'm a volunteer at the club. I run the Science and Technology Forum, similar to what Norma does in international relations. The other thing that piece of my background is I'm an investor in a black startup out of Silicon Valley called Maven.com. Maven got $10 million from Andreessen Horowitz last year. They are in the hair products business, so you probably know about them. But Maven is a company that's kind of a non-tech startup, and it has more to do with culture and those kinds of things. So my question is, are there startups in Africa, you mentioned Nollywood, that are not your typical tech startup, but they have to do with other kinds of social or cultural needs that can be accessed and made better through the use of this technology? And I think that's really your question, yeah.
Okay, all right, thank you. That's an awesome question. So we talk about tech startups, we like to refer to them as tech-enabled startups. So there are many industries that can be tech-enabled. I'll give an example, agriculture, for example. There are lots of, in Ghana, for example, there are lots of entrepreneurs that seem to be very interested in agriculture, right? But they know that they may not be able to increase the yields, but they know that they can hack the data that can help them do that. Right, so focusing on the tech part, the tech piece of it, that can hack the growth of whatever industry. Yeah, so Maven is an example. Hair products, but hacked with technology, agriculture, medicine, or music, Nollywood, etc. Yeah.
Yeah, and just on Nollywood, one of the startups we worked with, I don't have in the presentation, but we often reference is Iroko, which is really a startup designed to deal with monetization problems of Nollywood, because Nollywood has a huge problem with pirating. And it's impacted why Nollywood's had quality problems, because the investors can't recoup anything on the actual creative content. So Iroko is a VC-backed startup that we feature in the book that's basically started to digitize Nollywood and also find unique ways to send digital content in Africa to places that don't necessarily have the best broadband. And I think, Chris, is it right? Isn't Iroko the largest distributor, official distributor of Nollywood films in the entire world right now? Yeah. So that's one example. But startups, to your question, I'm moving into... It just amazes me the kind of startup examples, everything you can think of in terms of fashion, music, content, agriculture, education. And we profile a lot of that in the book. It runs the whole gamut. And Next question. And if you could just say your name, that'd be great.
Absolutely. My name is Alicia Balde, and I'm with the African Technology Foundation. And so I have to admit, I'm going to do a plug, and then I do have a question.
Okay.
So we have an event happening next Wednesday that's essentially a continuation of this conversation. We have four of the Demo Africa winners that are going to be in Oakland at the Impact Hub, in addition to the executive producer of My Africa Is, and it'll be an event that'll be highlighting African tech entrepreneurship. And so I invite you all to come and check that out next Wednesday at the Impact Hub in Oakland. So my question is, a lot of the conversation around tech and business development in Africa almost always doesn't include anything around sustainability. And I think we're at a time now where climate change is something that we can't ignore. And so I'm curious, really, from all different levels, what you all think about investment in kind of sustainable businesses, or how, you know, with e-commerce platforms, how we're able to change kind of the traditional business as usual into something that's more sustainable, since we're supporting folks on the ground, and even Uber as well with whatever that is, cars and whatnot. So
okay.
that's my question.
I'll let anyone jump in who wants to.
Matt, no, you ended with Uber, so we'll start with Uber here. No, I think that's one of the most exciting parts of our business in Africa, right? So one thing that's been at the background of a lot of what we're talking about, we haven't really mentioned explicitly, is urbanization, right? And so in the next, currently about half of humanity live in cities. By 2050, it'll be 66-67%. And so that's going to be 2.5 billion people more in cities by 2050. But so that's kind of wild. But what's really wild is how uneven the geographic distribution of that growth is going to be. So 90% of it or so is projected to happen in Asia and in Africa. And take Nigeria, for example. By 2050, Nigeria is going to add another 212 million people to its cities, which is an enormous challenge for a whole host of reasons, but particularly sustainability and environmental impact, right? And so if you look at that, you have burgeoning urban population, you have rising income, you have the continued aspirational status of private car ownership, and it's a pretty daunting future. And so that's why I think Uber's growth and platforms like Uber in sub-Saharan Africa present one of these exciting leapfrog moments, right? What can we do to potentially leapfrog private car ownership, wasteful private car ownership, and get toward more shared, sustainable car usage, right? And so that's where we are. I think you see that there's an economic aspect of that. Can we bring the cost of shared rides down? Can we get them there quickly? Does it make sense for people to adopt this so they don't go and buy a private car? There's also an interesting social and cultural element. Can you make it cool? And people don't talk about this a lot. People go buy a car because there's a social and there's a cultural cachet to having that. Can companies like Uber do enough to make carpooling the new default, the new norm, the way people simply decide to get around a vibrant, cosmopolitan African city in the 21st century? So that's a big challenge for us, but I think that's one of the most exciting things we're working on.
Yeah, great question. So from the early stage part of the equation, we're seeing that there's not a lot of abundance in terms of resources for a little funded startup or non-funded startup. So I have seen at least that most of the startups we talk with are already thinking, having kind of like a scarcity bias already makes them think by default on sustainability. So it's like, what's the minimum waste in anything? Products, resources, technology, assets, etc., right? So, which is really, really interesting that I just got to notice just about a few weeks ago when we're looking at some data. By the way, speaking about some data, we selected about top 100 startups on the continent, and some of the coolest ones you've heard about to ones that just launched, raised from 18 different countries, raised over $7.2 million and have like an average user base of 60,000 people. 60,000 users on your platform. And looking at that data, it was interesting that about of the 100, about 5 of them, which is like 5% of them, were specifically waste management companies, which is very mind-blowing, or like interesting. So people that are selling waste to companies or buying waste, there's actually a company that actually goes to people and buys waste from them. and uses it to process and manufacture some other thing that has to do with other stuff. So really, really interesting dynamic seeing how people think about waste and how people think about sustainability from the early stage part of the equation.
Anything, Chris?
Yeah. So for what we do, as I mentioned, we help retailers sell into Africa. And what we have found is we have actually found some retailers asking us, after we've posed questions to them on how can you now help our people? And by our people, I mean people back home in Africa. How can you help them? So we are talking to some companies over here on trying to see how we can bring back some of the African-made products into the U.S. and into the U.K. and sell that way. So we're definitely talking to a lot of companies about that. So our impact to the, sustainability umbrella is to try and see how can we help individuals in Africa also get their products out here, and what can we do to import products out of Africa and improve people's lives out there. So we're definitely looking at that aspect. So it's not just about exports, it's also about imports and improving people's lives out there.
So you'd be, in this case, you'd be taking capital globally and bringing it back to African entrepreneurs.
Absolutely.
And Africa has this huge trading culture. Okay. Why don't we do one more question, and then the panelists will be around, I think, a little bit after for people to talk about, and we have some books. But one more question, please.
Sure. I'm Colleen Byers, and you had talked briefly about the issues of delivery and logistics barriers, and hadn't heard about Uber Everything, and don't know if you want to take a second to talk about what you're doing and what you see future impact as being there, as well as I don't know if you both want to speak about impact of that in the future as well.
Sure. I'll take the narrow Uber and then open up to the guys who do this all the time. So Uber Everything, for those who don't know, is essentially Uber as a logistics network, delivering food, delivering retail. We do not have that operational yet in sub-Saharan Africa, though we do hope to have that very soon. South Africa will probably be the first market to have that. What we have done along those kind of non-core transportation lines, there's a few interesting things. The one that comes to mind is Uber Health we ran in South Africa, which was on-demand flu vaccines. It was massively oversubscribed. I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but there were several thousand flu vaccines, and basically you just push a button, the car would arrive, and you'd have five flu vaccines to administer, which is kind of interesting. But then when you think of it more broadly, what that represents is kind of a proof of concept for health service delivery and how you can spin that out. I think it's really exciting. Now, we just ran one pilot. It's very early days, but in terms of thinking what could come down the line, and where we could do that on the continent is pretty cool, but more broadly.
Well, as far as distribution and transportation of products, that's something that we rely on companies locally to do. There are many companies, and that's literally their business. In Africa, so in both Nigeria and in Kenya, we rely on companies locally that are doing it, and we prefer to give them the business because it's just helping the people. So that's how we do it. We also have something unique about our business, which is called we call the Mall for Africa Pickup Center. So it's think of your UPS store or your Kinko's FedEx store that you have now. You can go there and you can send your mail there and then go pick it up. It's the same thing. People can get their packages sent there and they go pick it up at the time that's convenient for them. So in Nigeria we have 38 pickup locations all around the country. So there's a pickup center near you type advertisement there. But that's how most of our customers actually get their products, because it's easier to go to a pickup location and get something than to have this long 9-hour window that you have to stay at home for. So people just rely on our pickup locations. But for those who want door-to-door delivery, we do that, but we use the local transportation distribution centers. And the addresses are, like you said, you know, behind the glass house, gate number 4, yellow. And that's the address, which is amazing. And you can always find it. So.
Yeah, if I'm added to that, I think so the logistics thing is like a huge problem. So I think I see it like more like a jigsaw puzzle. I think there's gonna be many iterations of what could work and what can work. And I think we'll eventually realize the most efficient way probably within the next 5 years. So thank you, Uber. We're gonna try many cool things. There are tons of logistics companies locally on the ground all over West Africa, especially that I know of on the across the continent. But I think we're going to figure out a way as more people enter the tech economy, start using tech products instead of going into e-commerce. I think more opportunities are going to come out to see how this guy wants to probably drive down his delivery costs, and this guy wants Uber to do everything, right? So I think there's going to be, yeah, I think there's going to be different experiments that are already going on right now, and I think eventually. It's gonna eventually fit together nicely. I think the broader challenge is so like Jake said about 54 countries right in Africa, 48 in sub-Saharan Africa. I think when we come up with a way, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think when we come up with a way for to move goods between countries all across the continent, then you'll see like. Big, massive J-curve in terms of e-commerce. So you know that the guy from Ghana doesn't really care if Mall for Africa is in Nigeria. It's just going to order stuff anyway. And because there's an efficient system, it's going to get to him in 24 hours or 48 hours. So I think that's like the bigger play. And I think we'll soon be there. Yeah. But it's going to take a while, but we'll get there. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a wrap.
Okay. Yeah. We'll call it a wrap. Our thanks to Jake Bright, co-author of The Next Africa, An Emerging Continent Becomes a Global Powerhouse, and also to Chris Folion, CEO of MallForAfrica.com, Matt Devlin of Uber, their global leader for international relations, and Toro Herrero, managing partner of Draper Dark Flow. We also thank our audience here and our listening audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.